The American History Podcast, Episode 3, Bonus Episode.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
All right. Well, I hope you like the new music, and welcome back. This is, as I said, this is a bonus episode, and today we're going to be talking about the nature of the United States. Now, thanks to California and the election of Donald Trump and everything that's going on in the news, it seems like the issues of secession and nullification are in the news lately. But so is the idea of what is the United States. And so all of this kind of stuff that's out there has me thinking about the Union and the nature of the United States and how most Americans today don't even understand the nature of what the United States is. Now, recently I was also listening to a podcast, which I tend to not do anymore, even though I love podcasts. But I was listening to this one particular podcast, and I'm not going to name the offenders, so please don't ask, but they sent me into meltdown. They said that secession was unconstitutional and that Abraham Lincoln, when he asserted that the Declaration of Independence created one nation, that nation being the United States, that he was correct. Now, this is so incorrect that I swear to you my head exploded, but luckily somebody had some duct tape somewhere nearby and they taped my head together, took me to the hospital, and I'm all better. Okay, I'm joking. But really, this just, wow. So, episode 3 was born. Thus, it's not about the militarization of the Southwest like I promised you last time. Instead, it's about this. So, this brings us to the question of what did the Declaration of Independence, if anything, actually create? Well, it sure as heck did not create the Hamiltonian or Lincolnian version of an indivisible nation. That's for sure. No matter what the Pledge of Allegiance says, no matter what your high school history teacher told you, that's incorrect. But you don't need to believe me. You can read the Declaration of Independence for yourself. The final paragraph states that they are creating this document because they want to publish, they want to declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. End of the quote. Now that's pretty clear. The colonies were independent sovereign entities. The Declaration was not creating one United States. It goes further, and it says that these states, and when we're talking about the 18th century, I should note here that people did not mean provinces when they used the word state, okay? They meant sovereign states, like the state of Great Britain, the state of France. And they said these states has, or the Declaration said, that these states had the right to do everything that all free and independent states do, such as declare war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, so forth and so on. Basically, things that independent nations have the right to do. Thus, they were independent. Now, the second piece of evidence comes from the Treaty of Paris of 1783. The King of Great Britain, George III, did not recognize the independence of one United States, but of the 13 states, again, as in sovereign state, not provinces. So even in 1783, the United States was still not a singular entity, but it was a union of 13 states. Now this is important, because if the United States was one unit, then the king would have recognized it as such. So even in 1783, there was no such thing as a unified American nation or a unified American people. Now, a third piece of evidence is one that maybe I could have mentioned earlier since we're kind of going in chronological order, but I'm going to mention it now. And that's the term Congress. Congress is also, or the term Congress is also an indication of the nature of the Union. In the 18th century, the term Congress meant to mean a meeting of representatives from independent states. The colonies sent delegates to a Congress, and not a parliament. These men were quite aware of what they were doing. They were quite aware of what they were saying. They picked that term on purpose. They called it a Congress versus a Parliament for a reason. Each colony saw itself as a separate entity, not a province of a unified, singular nation. That brings us to the Constitution. It does not create a unified, single entity either. And you can see this, there's numerous pieces of evidence for this. Contrary to the beliefs of this podcast I was listening to and to the beliefs of Abraham Lincoln, the Constitution was not created by the American people in aggregate. There was no such thing as the American people. So let's look at what Thomas E. Woods, a noted historian, got his PhD from Columbia, said in an extremely insightful book that he published in 2010 titled Nullification. He notes, the Constitution was not voted into effect by the American people. There was no nationwide vote. Instead, the states held separate conventions in which the voters sent delegates to these conventions. And then those delegates, representing the people of that state, debated and voted whether or not they would approve the Constitution. Lincoln and the supporters of the nationalist theory, the people that say that, you know, we were one United States from the very beginning, they never really address these issues. Why? Because they know they can't answer them. Now, since the Constitution is a compact between the states, we need to understand what this compact did. It created the federal government when the states took some of their own powers and then delegated them to the general or the federal government. Now, this grant of powers does not make the states subservient to the general government. And to think so is just plain wrong. In essence, what they are doing is they are creating an agent. The general government is their agent, and it is there to do their bidding. It works for them. This agent had the power, for example, of defense and all the other things that are enumerated in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8. But that's all. It can't do any more than what it is granted the authority to do. Thus, there is no such thing as implied powers. But again, don't take my word for it. Listen to the words of Pennsylvania's James Wilson in a speech to Pennsylvania's ratifying convention on October 6, 1787. Here, Wilson notes that the nature of the general government differs from that of the state governments. Quote, but in delegating federal powers, congressional authority comes not from tacit implication, but from the positive grant, end quote, of power. In other words, the federal system, that which is not explicitly granted to the general government is reserved to the states and or the people. If the general government did not explicitly have the power to, say, regulate the sale of marijuana, which it does not, then it cannot do that. The states can, but the general government cannot. Furthermore, keep in mind that the federation government is the agent of the states. They're the ones who created it. And just because the states gave the general government a power does not mean they cannot take that power back. They can do that too. Okay? So think about when you were in school. You know, it's your teacher grants the class the authority to grade a quiz. And everybody switches quizzes. And then the teacher calls out the answers. You grade your buddies. You tell them how many they missed. And then you all pass them forward. The teacher still has his or her sovereign power. They've given you a portion of it, but they can revoke that power if they figure out, hey, you clowns are messing around, okay? So at the end of the day, the teacher can always take that power back. Well, the same holds true in our federal system. I hope that makes sense. So what about unconstitutional laws? Well, that's where the idea of checks and balances is supposed to come in. In Federalist 78, Alexander Hamilton noted that there is no position which depends on clearer principles than that every act of a delegated authority, contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised, is void. No legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than the principal, that the servant is above his master, end quote. In other words, the general government is the servant of the states, not their master, and any law which contradicts the Constitution is thus not a law. Now, the controversy begins when we consider who gets to declare a law unconstitutional. If you've gone to public school in the United States, and I have plenty of listeners who don't live here in the United States, but if you came here to a school in the United States, you learn that this is the job of the Supreme Court. They are the final deciders. This is partially correct. Actually, all three branches of the government have a constitutional duty to invalidate any proposed law which is not in keeping with the Constitution. The Congress should not pass legislation, let's say, on health care. That's not a part of their enumerated powers. Even if, you know, you like some parts of what they've done or you like all of it, it doesn't matter. They do not have that authority. This is not a part of their enumerated powers. However, assuming that they do pass a law on, let's say, healthcare, okay, it is the duty of the president to veto that law. As for the federal court system, historian Kevin Gutzman notes that the idea of judicial review, which was conceived, or at least as conceived by John Marshall in Marbury versus Madison, and he always gets all this great credit for it, it's actually not all that novel, and it was simply taken from Alexander Hamilton's Federalist 78. And yes, the judicial branch has the right to review, okay? But so do the other two branches, the legislative branch, the executive branch, yes, and the judicial branch. They all have a constitutional duty to ensure that unconstitutional laws do not become law. However, let's play a game. What if, or what is a state to do if these three branches fail in their duty? Not that that would ever happen, right? But, you know, let's play. What if? After all, how can we expect the members of the general government to be impartial arbiters? Can we expect them to be impartial? Again, historian Thomas Woods notes, quote, the Supreme Court itself, after all, although usually pointed to as the monopolistic and infallible judge of the constitutionality of the federal government's actions, is itself a branch of, wait for it, the federal government, end quote. Thus, if there is a dispute, quote, between the states and the federal government, the resolution is to come from the federal government, end quote. Of course, now you're starting to see. This is silly. Woods makes a great point. How can one expect the federal courts, whose judges are appointed by the federal president and approved by the federal Senate, to be judges in cases to which their level of government is a party? Such a system would mean that eventually the states would become subservient to their agent. And Jefferson believed the states would never have agreed to such a system. And Madison also seconds this as well. And thus there must be a fourth leg upon which the stool rests. That is the states themselves. Now remember, this is a federal system, not a unitary system. Not only did Jefferson think that it would be absurd to have a unitary system, but so did another member of the founding generation, a guy named Spencer Roane. Now, Roane was a judge in Virginia, might have been Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, had Adams not made John Marshall the Chief Justice. There is evidence that Jefferson would have appointed Roane as Chief Justice. Now, Roane argues that the idea that the federal government can be the final arbitrator in a dispute between itself and the states is insane. He said you cannot have the federal government as the final judge. That would be just as ridiculous, let's say, as parents agreeing to allow one of their children to have the power to arbitrate a dispute between said parents and another one of their children. I mean, seriously, whose side is the child going to come down upon? His brother's or on the side of his parents? Take a guess. Go on. I'll wait for you to think it through. Got your answer? I thought you would. Now, look, I know that, okay, let's say you have a brother or sister and you're like, oh, heck no, man. He doesn't like me. I know he's going to side against me. But would he really? It's in his benefit to side with you because at some future date, the situation can be reversed and then you're going to help him out, right? Okay. So then, what is the remedy? Jefferson and Madison said that the states had the right to nullify unconstitutional laws within their own jurisdiction. So back to our example, and this, by the way, is their Virginia and Kentucky resolutions of 1798. So back to our example from earlier about the health care law. According to the Constitution, at least as approved in 8788, the Affordable Care Act should be unconstitutional, no matter what the Supreme Court ruled. So what are the states to do? Well, as an example, Texas could nullify that law, and it would have no effect in Texas, similar to what Colorado and Washington have done with the purchasing or the selling of marijuana. They've basically nullified federal law. Now, this might sound crazy, but it's a necessary element of good government. This is basically another check on an out-of-control government. And let's face it, if you don't like Trump, and I'm sure there's plenty of, you know, people who listen to this podcast that don't like Trump, wouldn't you like another check on his power? Yeah, it'd be a good idea. So, some objections. Now, yes, this is a mini bonus episode here, so I'm going to make it quick. I'll deal with one objection right now, and that's the idea of the supremacy clause to the Constitution. That clause says that the Constitution and the laws in pursuance thereof are the supreme law of the land, but an unconstitutional law cannot be in pursuance thereof. Its very nature negates that. An unconstitutional law is, in fact, not a law. And this thus leads us back to the idea of who is the final judge. I would suggest that it must be the states. For, as we saw earlier, they are the ones who created the federal government, thus they have the final authority. Now, if you're going to argue that nullification doesn't exist, then I would ask you, so then what's the rightful remedy of that's left to the states? Without nullification, you only have two other choices, and that's secession or to just sit back and take it. Now, the second one, the latter option, that's not an option at all. That's ridiculous. The states cannot be expected to just sit back and allow the federal government in a tyrannical manner to just hurt its citizens. That's ridiculous. Okay. Now, let's look at the secession part. Is secession legal? Is it constitutional? In a nutshell, yes. Yes, it is. Remember, the states agreed to create the Union. They came together and in their conventions, they ratified the Constitution. So the states have the right to reverse that process and leave. As a matter of fact, Virginia, in its ratifying of the Constitution, passed a ratification statement saying that it has the right to withdraw from the Union should the general government ever usurp its power. Now, this only makes sense if you consider the Union is like a marriage. You wouldn't expect a wife to sit around in an abusive relationship or a husband to sit around if his wife's being abusive, would you? Of course not. So then why should the states remain if the Union is abusive? And finally, remember that the United States was born in an act of secession from what they considered to be an out-of-control and tyrannical central authority. How logical would it be for those same states to create a central government from which they could never secede? It's not logical. It's crazy. All right, so two other objections real quick that people are likely to raise. First, the idea expressed in the Constitution that the Union is perpetual. All contracts are perpetual. As long as both parties are happy, the contract is still in effect, unless it's a contract that has an expiration date, such as the contract that you sign if you join the military. Okay, but if it doesn't have an expiration date, then it's perpetual. You sign a contract to go to work for X company, and as long as both of you are happy, you've got a contract. So why would the contract, which created the federal government, the contract between the states, why would that be any different? I would suggest it's not. Secondly, the idea that the Civil War settled the issue of secession. That's one that I had students say, well, but you know, the North won the Civil War, so all this is moot. Look, Lincoln successfully forced the states of the Confederacy through the force of arms to come back into the Union. That doesn't mean that he won the debate. Okay, if you and I are debating and I just shoot you in the head, did I really win the debate? I don't think I did. Okay. In that situation, and in the situation we have right now with California, for example, I would suggest that as long as California, if they want to leave the Union, fine. No big deal. As long as they have a convention and that convention votes to rescind their approval of the Constitution, well, in that case, I'd wish them well, wish them good fortune, and I'd go on with my life. And I believe that's that's the right way to pursue that. Okay, so that's it for today. We're going to get into this much more in depth at a later date. I just, you know, like I said, I heard a couple of things and I just had to rant a little bit here. So but that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, please share it around on social media, share it with your family or friends. Also, please don't forget to support the show and help keep the lights on around here, keep it free. And there's a couple of ways you can do that. Number one, whenever you make a purchase from Amazon, please enter Amazon through one of the links at our website, theamericanhistorypodcast.com. You can go to like the resources page or whatnot, click on one of the books, and you don't have to buy that actual item, okay? You just have to enter Amazon from our homepage. And that will help us out greatly, and I'll thank you in advance. Secondly, you can give us a 5-star review on iTunes. That helps to attract more listeners. The more listeners we have, the more likely the podcast is to continue well into the future. But anyways, thank you for listening, and have a good day.